Now what I'd like you to do is to take a look at the created universe understood by analogy. Referring to the handout, the created universe understood by analogy, I think it's helpful to start out by looking at it in a political sense. There's a political bias in the traditional Christian worldview, and this crude diagram is meant to represent not only the political bias, but also the system of analogies that we have to become very familiar with. This diagram illustrates the idealist and a logical worldview of the official Christian ideology of the Middle Ages. The official ideology of the Middle Ages, what was taught traditional Christianity, and something that you'll recognize if you are familiar with traditional Roman Catholicism or most brands, especially conservative brands of Protestantism. This official ideology says that the whole created universe follows the plan of God. In the diagram called the created universe in the top row, the third from the left, God is at the apex of the universal hierarchy. Let me just pause over this word hierarchy for a moment. Hierarchy comes from the word, the Greek word hiere, which means holy. What does holy mean? Conforming to the will of God. Anything God wants is good. And it also includes the term arche, or order. The term arche was originally a military term, but then later came to mean any kind of ordered arrangement. Cicero, the Latin philosopher and orator who translated a lot of Greek philosophical terms into Latin, used the Latin word ordo, orderness, for this Greek word arche. That's where our word order comes from. Therefore, hierarchy means holy order. A hierarchy is a relationship that is virtuous because it's pleasing to God. Pleasing to God because it is instituted, sanctified by God, divinely sanctified. Notice that God is a king in the universe. He's an autocrat, King of kings and Lord of lords, the overlord of the aristocracy. And I mentioned in the handout, sort of like the Godfather, Capo di tutti capi, right? If you've ever read Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather, Puzo's book, which is truly an interesting and well-done work, plays a lot, especially in the beginning, on this parallel that he draws between God, the Father, and the Godfather. There's no democracy in heaven, and therefore there shouldn't be any democracy on earth. Authoritarian relationships exist and were thought to be proper for earthly society because they were modeled on God's rule of the universe, and since God was an autocrat, then autocracy was the right way of running a society, any society, because society should model themselves on God's universe, which must reflect God's will. To put another way, by analogy, all virtuous relationships should reflect the hierarchical relationship of God to his created universe. Specifically, and here you can take a look at these diagrams, the state. Notice at the upper left we have the little hierarchy of the state. The prince, whoever he was, king, duke, emperor, depending on time and place, occupies the position in the state analogous to God's position in the universe. Okay, that's where, according to medieval theology and political thinking, that's where the authority of the prince comes from. The prince is standing in for God in his kingdom. Notice in the hierarchy of the family, also in the top row, the husband occupies the position in the family analogous to God's position in the universe, or the prince's position in the state. Therefore, the husband is overlord to his wife, right? Relationships in the family ought to be of the same nature as the relationship of the aristocracy to the people in the state, or the relationship of God to the created world, created universe, I should say, in the universe. Therefore, the husband vows to love and honor his wife, but the wife to love and obey. This is sanctified by St. Paul in the New Testament as well, of course. This worldview is in fact taken over from classical philosophy, developed under the Greek and later the Roman empires to justify the rule of the emperor. And Christians, as we will see, Christian philosophers simply took over a great deal of this late classical thought. Now, looking again at the diagram of the created universe, you'll notice it's divided into two sections by this line. Above the line, we have the intellectual world, angels, spirits, demons. Intellectual means being perceptible by the intellect. You can't see or smell or taste angels, spirits, demons, or God. You can only perceive them through the reason, through the mind. Below the line is the sensual world. This is the world that can be perceived through the senses. Sensual, therefore, is perceivable through the senses and not having to do with sex, which is what it means today, just like intellectual means perceptible through the intellect. And this, of course, is the world that we conventionally think of as the world. That's the world of the senses, the world we can see and sense in other respects. The modern scientists would say this is the only world that exists. So this diagram reflects the fundamental dualism of Christian thought, that there's an invisible world as well as a physical world. There's a spiritual world as well as a material world. Very important, right? Because God, of course, is spiritual. The Christian notion of a God is not like the Greek or Roman notion of a God who can come down and engage in battle and make themselves visible to men and so forth, but is completely intellectual. Note that man, or mankind, or humankind, but in images, very sexist time, we always refer to mankind or humankind as man, is written right on the line that divides the intelligible from the sensual. And that's because man, being mortal because of original sin, has a mortal, sensual part, the body, but was also thought uniquely among the inhabitants of the world, of the earth, to partake of the intellectual or intelligible world as well. Man's intelligible or intellectual part, or a vitally important concept, his rational part, his soul, has a beginning but no end, like the angels and spirits have beginnings but no end. It too is immortal, like all the beings of the intelligible universe, but had a beginning but no end. Only mankind partakes of both the intellectual, intelligible, and the sensual or material worlds. Only man among material beings has an immortal soul. In fact, it was taught that it was in this sense that God created man after his own image, according to the book of Genesis. Not that God was a man, or had arms and legs, but that man has a rational soul, clouded by original sin, but one that can still act, though imperfectly, according to the will of God, who is the font of reason, so that it is in the possession of a rational soul, capable of some degree of reason, that man resembles God, or was made in the image of God. That was the medieval interpretation of that part of Genesis. Let's take a little closer look at the creation story now. The political nature, I want to point out, of this worldview is evident at every turn, and nowhere more apparent than in the subjection of women to men. Man is said to be, superior to woman for a number of reasons, all of which stem from the fact that in the book of Genesis, Eve was created from Adam's rib and is therefore a secondary and inferior creation. In reality, however, if you take a look at the book of Genesis, you'll see that there are really two accounts of the creation of man and woman there. In the very first account, in Genesis 1, God simply creates man and woman together. There's no talk of creating woman from the rib of man. That doesn't come until the second account of creation. Traditional Christianity overlooked this first egalitarian creation story, where man and woman are created equally, and still does. To biblical scholars, the first, or egalitarian creation story, is the priestly or Elohist account, and it's a different account from the second, and we know that because the plural noun Elohim is used for the word God in this story, The same, by the way, as a later word for God, El, as in Bethel, for example, house of God, and also the same as the Arabic word Allah, or Al-Ilah, the God. Notice also that the word used for God in this first story is Elohim, which is a plural, reflecting the fact that the early Hebrews, early meaning whenever that story was written down, were polytheistic. It literally means the gods, but of course it's never translated that way, either by Hebrew scholars or by Christian scholars, because they would like to deny that Jehovah, that the Christian, Judeo-Christian God was one time a number of gods. Okay, so the first account of the creation of man and woman makes them equal. The second account is the Adam's rib version of creation, in which woman is God's afterthought and inferior because secondary to man. This is known by scholars as the Yahwist or J account of creation. And this is the version that's universally repeated in Christianity. Traditional Christianity and Judaism use this account of creation, not the first. Now why? Why did the ancients, or for that matter, contemporary Christians, not accept the first egalitarian story of creation and reject the second? Because to do so would give no sanction to authoritarian relations in the social and political world. All right? The first account was egalitarian. To give credence to that account would seem to imply that not only men and women should be equal, but in fact that everybody should be equal. Right? The second story institutes inequality among human beings and founds it upon the inequality of men and women, the superiority of men to women, or the authority of men over women. And this is the only story that's referred to in traditional Christianity. So it's not surprising that it's the second creation story that continues with the story of the Garden of Eden and the fall of man and woman. In fact, because of woman, Eve's successful temptation of Adam, the fall of man and the resulting divine curse on the human race, original sin, is also essential to an authoritarian society, whether medieval or modern. So the creation and fall of man, original sin stories, provided strong arguments for the inferiority of woman. The system of analogies that is represented in the diagram at the top of the handout, the created universe understood by analogy, is the basis of allegory, which is the mode of symbolism used in much medieval literature, or in most of it, and therefore we have to pay special attention to it. All the hierarchies outlined in the diagram and discussed above, and an unlimited number of other such hierarchies, were thought to be related to one another by analogy. Man is the king in the family, for example. The husband occupies the position in the hierarchy of the family analogous to that of the king in the hierarchy of the state. The king's authoritarian power was said to derive from the fact that the king occupied the place in the hierarchy of the state analogous to that of God in the hierarchy of the created universe. This, by the way, is the basis for the divine right of kings. But it goes far beyond that into other analogies, or systems of analogies, or hierarchies, and I suggest some of these important ones in the second lower row. Notice among the animal kingdom, the lion king of beasts. Why? Because he lives by preying on the rest of the animal kingdom. Just like the king and the nobility in human society live upon the labor of the common people, whereas none prey upon him. Note, by the way, that there is little or no squeamishness among the elite medieval writers concerning the essentially exploitative relationships in society. And that is that the aristocracy lived by exploiting the rest of the society, in particular the peasants. There's little or no squeamishness because it was firmly taught and believed by these men that this is the way God intended it to be. This is God's divine law. It's not to be questioned, and therefore it must be proper. This is why the lion figures in the coats of arms of the royal family of England and others. For the same reason, of course, the eagle is the king of birds, another bird of prey, which preys on others and flies high above the rest. And the eagle resists the Roman emperor and the Russian czar and other rulers as well. Interestingly, the eldest son of the king of France in the Middle Ages was called the Dauphin, which means dolphin. Shakespeare calls him the dolphin, right? Translation of the word dauphin. Why? Because the dolphin is king of fish. Because the dolphin leaps high into the air, so seeming to yearn for the higher element, air, and residing in the highest reaches of his own element, water. Just as the eagle seems to be soaring to the highest regions of the air, the dolphin is not necessarily a predator, but simply the noblest of fish because trying to exceed the limits of his own realm, perhaps. Anyway, the system of analogies is very, very fundamental.